Blog Talk Radio.
Who came up with the idea of maybe taking 2 weeks off between shows is an absolute genius. I got to find that person and thank them. I want to thank you for clicking into When Black Men Talk. This is our summer version, and for the summer, we're doing 2 shows a month, which gives us 2 weeks off between shows and an opportunity to kind of refresh, think about some things, and, of course, enjoy the summer. You say, what is When Black Men Talk? Come on, you got to know this by now. It's our provocative talk of when we get together as three gentlemen sharing our perspective on life, love, and relationships, always shooting for an honest self-evaluation. And I love the fact we don't shy away from some things that need to be said. This show, we're going to focus in on mental health and faith. That's going to be the two things we kind of grab hold to this show. Before we do that, from time to time, we kind of salute and give flowers to folks. And I wanted to salute this young lady here, Valerie Daniels Carter. Your sister is one of the minority owners of the NBA champs of Milwaukee Bucks, and she's a graduate of HBCU, Lincoln University. I'm sure a lot of us watched the finals and realized that she was holding down part ownership. Speaking of ownership, let's welcome some luxury to the show. Let's welcome back Marcy for peace. Marcy, how you feeling?
I'm feeling good, Mark. How are you?
I'm always good. Good to have you on. Always feeling good, and always good to have you back here. I'm excited to have you back. And it's not going to be the only time. That I'm looking forward to. With that being said, enlighten us about the ultimate power.
Oh, the ultimate power. That's my baby. That's my passion. Ultimate power worldwide. Yeah, it's my coaching and speaking brand, and where I have my domestic violence work now kind of pulled all into one under one umbrella before things were kind of discombobulated. But basically helping women make sure their mind and their money's right, wealth and wellness coaching, treating the whole human, basically.
Sounds good. Thanks for coming in and allowing us to hang out with us, because we're not used to having luxury on this show, so if the gentlemen seem a little discombobulated, they'll come around. They'll be okay. And the gentleman I'm speaking of is Mr. Charles and Mrs. DeMaurice. Mr. Charles, Mr. DeMaurice, how you feeling?
All right. Speak for yourself, man. I am a luxury.
So, Mr. Charles, what's going on, boss? He's always somewhere up in the cut. Man. Hang on a second. Maybe let me make sure I got Mr. Charles in there. Hang on, push the button. There it is. Mr. Charles, what's going on, sir?
See how he does me? Talking about luxury. You got you the man. You the man, but you the wizard behind the curse. Sorry, though. I'm done, man. I'm gone. I'm done.
You can't be done, boss, because I was just ready to ask you at this point in your life, what inspires you, sir? What kind of gets you motivated? If you have to think about what makes you wake up every day, what pushes you to live, what inspired Mr. Charles?
Not being muted on shows, then I really have something I want to say. No. seriously. I think I would say right now, part of it is helping youth grow from a mental standpoint. And I'm doing that a lot with my niece and my nephew and some other folks as well. That really inspires me. The other thing, too, is working with close associates or even family members with helping them to grow projects. Of course, we think about making money, but working with them on businesses and ventures together and seeing things grow, similar to what we're doing here, that really inspires me because I've always wanted to do things where I work with people that I care for and like, and we can make some things happen. That really inspires me to do great work.
Good stuff. Marcy, come on in. Ms. Marcy, come on. The same question for you. At this point in life, what inspires you?
What inspires me is knowing that I'm making a difference. So I kind of have this personal mantra for myself to lead with my heart and love with my head, and to leave a legacy that my daughters can be proud to say that's my mama and that's what she stands for. And so particularly with the domestic violence work that I do, I was telling another young lady on an interview today that sometimes it can feel like sitting in the ocean, but when you get a message back from a woman who felt like she was at rock bottom and couldn't see the light, and she tells you that something that you did or something that you said changed her for the better, that's the best gift ever, and that's what inspires me to keep going.
Strong stuff right there. Mr. DeMaurice, I'm going to bring you in, sir. What inspires you at this point in your life? What gets the motor turning a little faster?
Well, I have to say there are a number of things, a number of people. My students that I teach, been in the teaching profession on university level for about 15-plus years. And each group that comes in, you have certain students that give you hope for the future that we're going to be okay. So just really kind of looking at their perspectives, what they're thinking, how their mind is being shaped and what they have to offer, that inspires me. Being around inspirational people. I love being around inspirational people that keep you focused and keep that light on. The ones that came before me, looking at history, folks that have strived and done great things before me, lets me know that if I look like those people and I am of those people, that, you know, I can do just as much as they're doing, if not more. And not only just people that came before me, but, you know, you guys know my pop, my uncle, family members, man, who every time you put your head down low and think you can't do it and you talk to them, you get a extra bit of juice just to keep going one more day. I think I shared stories about my mom before she passed, you know, wanting to quit high school. And she was like, come on, I know you can do this. This is in your wheelhouse. Let's go. You're going to do this. You're going to do great things. So there, I tend to try to surround myself with a lot of inspiration and inspirational people, man. So those are a few that I'll list.
You know, it's interesting. I would have doubled down on something you said about the ancestors, because it came to me today. I want to do a show where we pay homage to our ancestors. When I say ancestors, not the ones that we know and not the ones that we speak of, the ones that basically set the foundation years ago, the ones that took the beatings, that took the whips years ago for us to be able to do what we do and the way we can do what we do. So we haven't had a homework project in a while. And probably for the month of August or maybe September, that'd be a project where each of us would just write a paragraph or two to our ancestors that long came before us, but what they did helped set the stage. And Marcy, if you like, you can come back with that show as well. I think that's something that from time to time we all should do. I know sometimes we go back and we look at our family tree and we find out different names. And I'm going to say, Charles, I think you did that once. And I said, personally, I'm afraid to go back and find out that too much information, because I know somewhere in the heart it would hurt me to realize some of the things that they went through. But with that being said, I do want to take time out to pay homage. What inspires me, realistically right now, I feel like I've lived a good, full life. I'm not saying I'm ready to go or want the life to be short, and I have many more days hope to come my way. But I want to set things up realistically for the kids that I have when I'm not here, for them to basically be on a strong, solid foundation, financially, of course, mentally, religiously. So that's where, when I look for my days ahead, that's the work, that's the churn. Not saying it hasn't been the days behind me either, but I want to make sure that when I'm no longer here, their road will be a lot easier than my road has been. And if I can do that and continue to accomplish that, my time on this earth has not been a bad time at all. Gentlemen, we're going to move on and turn our attention towards mental health. As I spoke earlier, you know, mental health is a personal condition with regard to the psychological and emotional well-being. But emotional well-being is something that's real interesting, because I believe there's a battle that rages quietly for good mental health. We all seek to have it and we desire it, but just because when you maintain it, you got to fight to maintain it, and there goes the battle. We're going to look at anxiety. We can look at anxiety, depression, panic attacks, there's a few things we could kind of basically hung our hat on, but I chose anxiety to kind of go with that one. And it's interesting, anxiety can lead to high blood pressure. It can weaken your immune system. It can cause stomach problems and chronic fatigue. So I look at anxiety like this. It tends to kind of come upon us without a notice. It doesn't send you an invitation. It doesn't Western Union you. It just kind of basically kind of find itself there. You kind of start to think, and before you know it, you feel a little anxious. So I'm trying to understand, in a sense, Mr. DeMaurice, do we understand the personal cause of our anxiety?
I don't think so. I think we're so busy, you know, just trying to live life and do what we do, that when it comes upon you, you don't really know how to handle it. Or I know in the Black community, we kind of, when we see people kind of suffering from any kind of mental illness, we kind of shy away from it and we try not to understand it. We kind of put them off to the side, that they're different and there's something going on with them, and we don't really engage. So in a nutshell, I don't think we really, really understand all the ins and outs of anxiety and what it can do to you, both mentally and physically.
Ms. Marcy, do we personally understand the nature of our personal anxiety?
No, I don't think we do either. I think that a lot of times what we do is we push down emotions, or we tend to deny emotions for fear that it's going to make us feel depressed or anxious or upset or something like that. And that by stuffing them away and locking them away, that we can kind of just pretend that they don't exist and go on like nothing's wrong, and not realizing, like to your point, that the anxiety begins to manifest itself, whether you want it to or not. So ignoring the problem doesn't avoid the problems of anxiety or depression or any kind of mental health issues. And then you go on into the clinical stuff, and that's yet another whole ballgame there.
I think in our community, I can speak for myself, coming up, mental health was kind of broken down into two things. You were crazy or you was not crazy. It didn't have a deeper definition or terminology than that. It was just either you were or you weren't. So if we saw you be a little, if you came across being just a little different mentally, like Mr. Reese, we kind of pushed you aside and in a sense just called you crazy and just kind of chose not to deal with you. Mr. Charles, are we understanding the personal cause of our anxiety?
Most times I would say no, but I think it depends on the individual, because like I can only speak for myself. I know there's been many times that I probably felt anxious or I felt like I was dealing with anxiety. And then I remember some of the lessons my dad taught me. And then, of course, we go through it because it sneaks up on you. But then I also start to really think about what's going on. What am I facing? Because the unknown or being uncertain about things and new challenges sometimes will bring anxiety to me. Well, my dad used to always remind me, let's take a step back if you can, because you can't always can't. Take a step back, look at it for what it is, and now remember where you're at and remember the power that you have inside yourself. I learned that very young. I can't say that about everybody, but for myself, I didn't have a lot of options after my dad passed, so I had to start to try to develop certain kind of behaviors. But I will not lie, I still have my moments. So I'm not immune at all, but I still sometimes just try to think about what my dad taught me and not try to stay in it if I can, anxiety that is, for too long.
Yeah, I don't think we tend to understand it for a degree, because I think we don't truly want to deal with it. Excuse me, I think when we feel it, like Marcy said, we want to kind of get away from it. We deny it. We tend to believe it doesn't exist. And one thing we tend to not do, we don't talk about it. We don't really open up and share and talk, because we feel if we communicate about it, it's a sign of, especially for men, it's a sign of weakness. And I'm always saying that you got to have someone that you open up to and talk to and just let loose. There's a cat that him and I kind of fell out for a period of time, not talking. And we worked together for a period of time, and we didn't. And throughout the time we didn't work together, we stayed in contact and always kind of just got together. It was not even once a month and just talk. So when I spoke yesterday, and we haven't talked for, I'm going to say at least maybe 10, 12 months. And part of that's my fault. I'll take responsibility for that. But just talking to him yesterday, we were talking for 10 minutes, and I said to him, bro, I miss these conversations. The openness where we just let loose and we just talk, it was no guard. It was just basically running through things of our personal lives and stuff of that nature. And be able to have a conversation where you just open the door and you're not afraid to walk through mentally does a lot of good. Mr. Charles, you spoke of the word uncertainty. And a lot of times we hear stress. We hear the word stress, you know, I'm stressed out, blah, blah, blah. But underneath that, I really believe is uncertainty. And uncertainty is a serious stressor on the mind. And I don't think sometimes we understand when we're feeling stressed. A lot of times it's based on we're not thinking how something's going to work out. We believe that we understand and we can move things around and we can make things better. And we realize when we can't, when uncertainty hits you in the face and you realize that power doesn't really lie within you, here comes the stress. So with that being said, I want us to find a situation that we faced uncertainty and give us an example. Marcy, I hate to come to you first with this one, but you're up.
So mine is, I used to be a bank executive. I was with the same company for about 26 years, relocated to Arizona with the company, felt very secure in the position that I held there. At the same time, I started running my coaching business. It was kind of operating in two very, very different worlds. And then one day, they called me into the office and had flown in to hire executives from back home in Iowa. And one of the people there was from HR, and they had a gold envelope in their hand. And they informed me that they were doing a reorganization and that my services were no longer needed. And so as I hear you all talking about uncertainty, I remember sitting in the meeting room that day and thinking, well, is this a blessing and a curse? And I hadn't been happy in that job for a long time, but I wasn't ready to walk away because I was uncertain what my future would look like. My kids didn't even know me as having ever worked anywhere. I felt like that was who I was, not realizing that's just what I did, and that was not who I was. And so when they gave me the envelope, I was like, okay, this is my opportunity to figure this out. But there were several days after that where I was excited about my future opportunities, but I didn't know what they were going to look like, and I was like, I've never had to just pay my bills off of my own ability. I always had the backing of a corporate career, a substantial corporate career, so that was probably, it was a hard time trying to figure out, like, who am I after this, and what does the future look like? And it was very uncertain. It felt very anxious. And probably, if I'm honest about it, probably bordered on a little bit of depression. And then I just had to kind of dig into the coping strategies that I teach clients about and start doing my work on myself.
Mr. DeMaurice, Mr. Charles, we can find a better person to come up here and be part of what we do. I don't know if everyone's feeling that because it's not easy to basically do what we do. We've been saying that and understanding that for a while. And this young lady comes on, you throw something to her, and it's like, bang, it's out the park. It's gone. So I want to say it's still going.
Yeah, that means life can stop it. Let me collect my pearls. Thank you.
No, because this is not easy, and you're doing a hell of a job. We appreciate it, and we're hoping that, you know, you decide to keep coming because it's something that's valuable to the show, and I'm serious about that. I'm happy to have you on, and I appreciate that you're here. I'm going to jump in real quick and throw my uncertainty, because my uncertainty is kind of current in a sense. And it was my second oldest brother took ill a few months ago, and him and I really haven't been that close. Love him deeply, and even though we haven't been close over the years, it never changed the love, never changed how I felt about him. No animosity, no anger, nothing of that nature. But when I heard he was ill, kind of severely ill. His kidney, at first, he had a kidney transplant, and the kidney that he got had transplanted in his body got to the point where it was only working 20%. And to me, when I heard about that, and I didn't hear he was on dialysis, I kind of questioned it a little bit in my head, but, and I left it alone. But it was not, it could have been uncertainty, like, well, okay, where is he going to next? What's going to happen with his body physically and stuff of that nature? And from that point on, he did go in the hospital. He had some blood clots that sometimes they thought he had a minor stroke, but it's really his blood pressure was high. And I found myself really never kind of feeling uncertain about him. And that was a little strange to me, but not really, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking that God's going to pull him through. And if he doesn't, I'm content with that. I didn't allow myself to go there with the uncertainty. And I remember years ago, before he had his first kidney, I actually take him out quite a bit when he was on, it was, his kidney was failing, and he was on dialysis. And I remember my sister said to me one time, have you looked at Larry? Because you're taking him out, and Larry's not that healthy. And I looked, and she said it, I looked at him, he was frail. But I was treating him like, you know, he was his normal self. And I had to kind of stand back and look and realize, you know, he was frail. But just trying to be who I was to him and trying to keep things normal at that time, for some reason I didn't pay attention to it. I didn't pick up on it. But that would be my, if I have to jump something or give something for uncertainty. And that was just basically something happening in the near future. And that's why I kind of wanted to kind of, I mean, the recent future, recent times, I should say. And that's why I kind of wanted to pull that one out and give that one. And I'm going to toss it to you, Mr. DeMaurice, something of a time of uncertainty that you dealt with. And please share an example, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to try to make this as quick as possible. I remember you and I, when you came here to Chicago, when we were both married, and we had a conversation about, you know, this ain't working out. Both of us were in a situation this ain't working out, and this is what we're going to, you know, how to come out of this. And I remember at the time, you know, I was planning on separating and divorcing and all that stuff. But to my knowledge, there was nobody else on both sides of my family who ever gone through this. So it was my first time, and even though I'm in the business of and in the industry of social services, and you know this is my wheelhouse of knowing all this stuff. When you go through it yourself, you don't really kind of anticipate the ins and outs of all the stuff that's happening. And so as I was moving forward trying to do it, I was always prayful that, you know, if I'm going off the track, please put me on the right track to do what I have to do, or if this is the wrong thing to do, just give me those signs. And so I remember going to file the papers. And when I say it was like a whirlwind standing in the building trying to, you know, go to the right places, all this stuff, trying to do all this stuff and trying to put, you know, put the right paperwork in, do everything the right way, I was like, man, this is overwhelming. I don't know what to do at this particular point. Lo and behold, I had a colleague that I worked with years ago that we had lost contact because she took a position somewhere else. She saw me standing out in the hall. She's like, what you doing here? And I explained to her what I was doing there. And she's like, oh, come on with me. I'll tell you exactly where you need to go. And so what I was finding as I was going through that process, that things were kind of clearing my path. No matter how much she was trying to fight it and do all this other stuff to derail me, people were put in my place. My path was clear to do certain things. And it, you know, I don't know if people believe in how the universe speaks to you, but, I started seeing, every time I looked at the clock or seeing certain things, I would see the number 1, 2, 3 or 1234, whether it was day or night, or I start seeing the numbers 1111, whether it was 11 o'clock at night, 1111 in the morning, I start seeing that. And when I start researching that, basically those numbers are like kind of signals that you're on the right track. You're going in the right direction. And so even in my uncertainty, I started seeing how people and certain things started to align to keep me on the right track, to keep me focused, to keep me going forward and accomplishing what I was trying to accomplish at that time. And it was a great comfort to me because at that particular time, like I said, nobody in our family that I know of or nobody in, as far as my friends had gone through that. And I was kind of going through that myself, trying to figure out, okay, how do I navigate this so that I will be okay? And it just seemed like all these things started like to open up. The path was clear. All this stuff was kind of pointing in direction. Here's where you need to go. And it was a very powerful acknowledgement to me and kind of revelation that, you know, once you kind of, I always believe that once you pray to the Creator, whatever decision or thing that you do, the Creator is going to always put you on the right track. And so if you're going on the off the track, there's going to be something that says, oh, that's not the way. Here, I'm going to put you right here. Let's start again. And so that particular time in my life, I really saw that come, I mean, just shining through so clearly that it was amazing to me.
Man, I remember that night vividly, you know, you and I sitting in your automobile. And sometimes I think back to that night, and I always think the same thing when I think back to it. I just wish we had some whiskey, bro. That's all we needed that night. It's a whiskey while we're talking.
Yeah.
And sipping just a little bit, bro.
Men drinking.
Somehow we didn't have a brown bag. But honestly, man, that night, when you think about it, that night turned our lives in different directions, bro. It really did. You know, we basically opened up and shared, and, you know, you weren't happy in your marriage. You knew, I guess I made it clear I wasn't happy in mine. And we both left that automobile, man, and our lives went in different directions in terms of marriage. It just has. And I can honestly tell you, bro, I haven't looked back one day and regret the decision I made. I'm pretty sure you could probably say the same thing. I haven't looked back. So
yeah.
I can't remember some of the things we said, but I just know we came out. We went in different directions, and I'm thankful for that. So I'm thankful for that. Mr. Charles, a time of uncertainty, my brother, that involves uncertainty. And give us an example, please.
Yeah, I'm with D. Marie. Don't want to belabor this too long. But I had a decision. I was trying to figure out something. I applied to go to graduate school. And if you know me, it was my dad's dream for me to go to college. I had no aspirations whatsoever. I didn't think I belonged there. I think my high school grades, my transcript said that. But my dad kept saying, you need to go. You need to try. The only way you're going to really accomplish things, you need to have that education. And so I went for it. And that was a struggle to be accepted at Wilberforce University. And then it was a struggle to actually to graduate and finish. I had to put a lot of hard work in. And then I was trying to figure out what the rest of my life was going to be like after undergrad. And I had a professor that mentioned to me that you should think about graduate school. And I said, I barely got out of undergrad. What are you talking about? There's no way in hell I'm going to get to graduate school. Anyway, long story short, I did apply. It was very prestigious at Ohio State. Out of 100 people, I think I told you guys, and I'm not sure if I shared it with our guests, but there was only 100 people accepted in the class at the time, and there were only 5 African-Americans accepted out of the 100, and it was myself and 4 sisters. So there was a lot of expectations, a lot of things going on, and there was oftentimes I felt lost, in particular where in graduate school, for those that don't know, you have to maintain a certain grade point average. If you go below that grade point average and you don't finish with that grade point average, by the time you graduate, then they can send you packing. And one of the worst things for me was I would have been a total failure if I had to go home. That was the motivation for me. And I remember looking at my situation and looking at my GPA. I needed to bring it up. And I cried like a baby because I was like, I don't see a way out. I don't. And I just don't see it. And I said, they're going to kick me out. And I'm going to have to go home. And I'm a failure. And I'm like, everything my dad told me I work for is all down the tubes. It's going to go down the tubes. And as DeMarie said so greatly, sometimes you got to turn it over. And I was in my little one-bedroom, whatever, efficiency apartment, whatever you call it, crying like a baby. And I prayed and I asked for guidance. And I opened up some books. I looked at my transcripts and whatnot. And I was so engaged in trying to think about failing and having to go home. And I was trying to, like, how am I going to get these grades up? And then something just came over me. He said, well, let's take a look at your whole portfolio and see what's going on. And then it dawned on me that while you're sitting here crying about trying to stay, you don't have that much longer. You can graduate if you put your mind to it. And if you orchestrate the classes, you don't have to be a Superman to do that. Get the right classes, do what you have to do, move on. And it just opened the door. And I just really, I dove in, and really connected with my inner self, along with the connecting with the Creator. And I was on a mission. I think I had like, because I was going part time, I was working, and I had like four semesters to go, and my GPAs were off the charts, because I literally had to structure and dove in, and I finished, and I was like, that's probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. And even after the orals that you have to have with the three-person committee, after they told me that I had passed, I literally walked outside the building and dropped to my knees and thanked God. I said, because I know this wasn't me, not by myself. I dropped to my knees, and I was like, thank you. So, yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you, Three, for sharing. It's interesting because one thing about uncertainty, if it's treated correctly, uncertainty, if you kind of build on it, will allow you to basically, next time you face it, deal with it with more confidence, more strength. In a sense, your temperament and your prior experiences will affect the way you handle uncertainty. The funny thing, scientists believe if you accept the situation of uncertainty and not fight against it, it helps relieve your mind that it's a possible threat, and this way it forges an opportunity to deal with it better. So I'm going to throw this one at you, Mr. DeMaurice. Is that something, as you can see in the science way of thinking, to be relevant, sir?
Yeah. I mean, if you your brain is amazing, man. And whatever you believe, you can achieve. You hear that all the time. But if you have a belief so strong, it can either move you in a constructive way or a destructive way. And so the power of belief and the power of just thinking positively will take you a long way than you really kind of just being negative and thinking that you can't do something, then you're going to be right. You can't. You're going to manifest that. But if you have in your mind that I believe I can do this, then nothing's going to, be withheld from you. And you're dealing with positivity. Usually, like in my life, I know once I'm in that direction of positivity and thinking, okay, I believe I can do this, then people will start coming. People start coming, even with this show, bro. I share with you both what I wanted to do on the show, a sports show. I want to do this. This is what I think the direction we should go. And there are many folks that I approached with this, and you were the two that stuck and stayed. And what we were able to accomplish throughout this time doing it, it was just a belief that, you know what, I'm going to do this. But, and whoever's going to be with me is going to be with me. We're going to do this together. Or whoever's not going to do it, I'm just going to do it by myself. And so it was that strong belief that pushed it forward. And you mentioned all the time. I remember I said, I want you to do a talk show. I was like, I seriously thought you were going to do a music show, because music was always what we were all about. I'm like, he's either going to do a gospel, a blues, something, along that line. He said, I want to do a talk show. And I'm like, wait a minute. What are we going to talk about for 2 hours? You got 2 hours to do this. What are we going to talk about for 2 hours? It was that belief you had that I think this will work. And look at where we are now, man. You're on different platforms, yes, things of that sort. And so even when I didn't see it, and I'm like, got off the phone with you, I'm like, hey, you're going to do a talk show. What are we going to talk about, trying to be the male Oprah and all this other stuff? I'm like, all right, I'm going to go with it. If he has that belief, I'm going to go with it, because I know how he is. Once he's on track to doing something, ain't no turning him back. So I'm going to roll with it, see what we got. And, but the power of belief and that positivity and getting people around you that will support that, man, it weighs a lot. A lot of people don't really realize how much that weighs and how to get things done in life.
Yeah, you're right, bro. You're absolutely right. And like you said about the sports shows, when I put this together, and I want to thank you for Mr. Charles. So basically, even in the beginning, if you didn't see it, you two always showed up and were present and were there and became a serious part of it. And I always say you two are the fabric of what we do here. But you're right. In the beginning, when sometimes you bring people your vision, they can't see it as clearly as you. They can't understand it. And just like what you said, you talked to other folks. I engaged some cats in conversation about doing this, and they all like the idea. And when you talk to them personally, they can't shut up sometimes. They just go, da-da-da-da-da, they keep going. But when you said, hey, you're going to be talking, and people are listening to you and understanding what you're saying, they all ran, man. They ran. They did not want to basically be part of this in that sense, where they didn't want someone to kind of hear them and hear their thoughts. And, you know, I guess that's okay. But to me, as men, we should always be open up and strong enough and stand and be able to talk. And, you know, when you came with the idea about doing this, man, I had nothing. I told you this before, I had nothing. And I said to me, I ain't got time. I don't have this. We can do it. And 2 days later, man, I could really say God said to me, do something about men talking. Get men to talk. Just find a way to get them to talk, and because a lot of times they don't talk. They're afraid to talk. Open up and get them talking. From that point on, here we are. This is where we are. Appreciate it. Ms. Marcy, coming to you. Are these scientists onto something when they say basically if you just don't fight it and you go with it, could be the best thing for you?
Yeah, I do think that you have to just kind of accept, you know, one of the things that I do is reality-based coaching, which means accepting where you are, regardless of how you got here. And then a lot of the work that I do with the cognitive behavioral therapy is working with fears and understanding where our fears come from. But the beginning of all of that is really just acknowledging where you are. Like, you can't fight two battles at once. You can't chase two rabbits at the same time. You can only chase one. So if you're busy fighting the reality of where you are, you can't start the battle to go where you need to go to. So I absolutely think that's a true statement.
I think it came to you already, Mr. Charles. I'm not sure about that. I did, bro. I apologize. I'm coming back to you. Are the scientists hitting the bullseye with this one, Mr. Charles?
I think so, from the standpoint of, as has been said earlier, putting things in perspective, because you can be overwhelmed, things can overtake you, but if you put things in perspective, you can say, okay, here's the situation, here's what I can do next to move forward, because something overcomes you or overwhelms you, it can just always have you always in the same place because you're stuck, because you're more worried about what's happening and how you feel then you are actually about settling down, gathering, composing yourself, and then figuring out a way what's your next step. So I think you're on track in that regard.
I'm sure we all kind of heard this phrase coming up, you know, here probably much now, but we know the phrase, the mind is a terrible thing to waste. A mind is also something that should be protected, guarded, developed, and I believe feed a diet consistently of positive thoughts, because the mind really is a central processing area. You alluded to earlier, Steve, you said the mind is something that, man, really, there's nothing that the mind can't achieve that really can't happen if we kind of really work at it. It's a place of strength, as Ms. Marcy said about fear. It's a place of fear. And fear of reality kind of breaks down the fibers of the mind. You know, we're afraid and we're thinking that we can't do something and we're on that path. You're kind of breaking down the fibers of your mind, while strength tends to elevate the mind. So personally, when you think about it, I'm wondering in a sense that which one are we doing more of from a personal standpoint, Mr. Charles? Are we elevating our mind or are we breaking it down? So,
wow, I think that kind of depends on the individual. I know for myself, I think about elevating my mind and more, and I think part of it is I remind myself of things that I've overcome. I always do that because there was a time where a lot, when we think about our folks in general, our culture, our people, we're always told what we couldn't do. We were always put in a certain place. And if it's like, for instance, when you had the Africans that became slaves, when they learned how to read, that was always a bad thing, and they were really punished for that. But for myself, I always thought about what I've overcome. And it's like, okay, you can do this, so let's think more positive. Try to read as much as I can, and fear is going to be there, but I don't want it to be the majority of my thoughts or give it enough power where it can break me down.
Mr. DeMaurice, when you think of the mind, are we tearing it down with fear, or are we elevating it with strength, my brother?
I know personally, elevating, man, always elevating, always trying to get better, always trying to be more successful in what I do. I was having this conversation with my martial arts instructor, Sifu, And usually on Fridays, it's weapon training. Before I go in there a little bit earlier, because I want to train on, you know, some other stuff. And I'm always picking his brain. And one of the things that we were talking about is that what I notice sometimes, it gives me a lot of praise, you know, during training and things of that sort, or he's always keeping his eye on me, which I appreciate. But I notice that when he does that, it gets me off focus. It gets me a little bit off focus, like I'm thinking I'm it now. You know, I'm the guy now. And I told him last Friday, I said, stop doing that. I said, I want you to only give me attention when I'm doing something wrong or doing something I need to improve on. I said, that's going to get me better. I don't want to get off focus thinking that I've arrived. I still got dudes to play. And he understood that. He understood that, and he appreciated that because he's like, you know, he said he's the same way too, that, you know, once he gets kind of praise and pat on the back, that he kind of forgets what got him there. And so I never want to kind of lose that hunger to get better, losing that hunger to not wanting to know everything I need to know about mastering what I'm doing. And so so I'm always in that elevation that once I get to one level, and he was saying, hey, once you get to a certain level, I'm going to give you praise for that, you know, outside of everybody else, but I'm going to honor what you said. And he recognizes that, you know, the sky wants to get better and better and better. And and basically told me, so I'm going to give you everything I have to make sure you get to that point, because he said, I've never seen a student that has that hunger and passion that wants it more. Not too many people in that school wants it more than you. So I'm going to honor what you said, and I'm going to be on you about doing what you need to do to get better at this and one day maybe teaching your own school or whatever. And so, yes, yeah, always elevating, always reading, always learning. And I told one student of mine, I can live 1,000 years and not know everything that I need to know. And so in this time that I have now, I'm going to try to pack it in with all the stuff that I need to know to not only for me to be successful, but people around me to be successful. So it's always elevating and elevating the people around me at the same time.
Ms. Marcy, I believe I know this answer, but I have to ask it anyway. Tearing down the fibers or elevating, Ms. Marcy, for you?
So for me personally, it's definitely building up, but I say that with, let me drop a pin in that and say that it wasn't always that way. You've heard the saying, the five people that you surround yourself with the most affect kind of where your path leads, right? And the people that you surround yourself with have a huge impact on how you think. And the way you think drives what you do, and what you do drives your results. So if you're surrounding yourself with people who are complacent or content or don't have a vision or don't have goals or things like that, then you're going to find yourself kind of falling in line with that a lot of times. Versus if you surround yourself with people who are, you know, in kind of a personal development world, have beliefs, and, you know, masterminds are great tools to kind of break yourself out of that. But for me personally, before I moved to Arizona, I was content living a basic average life. I had no vision for it. Like, if you would ask me then what I'd be doing now, 12, 13 years later, it looked nothing like this. I didn't even have conceptually the ability to comprehend, you know, writing books and public speaking and all those things. And so you have to be intentional about your development. You have to be intentional about surrounding yourself with positivity and finding ways when you feel yourself getting stuck to be able to say, and one of the things I tell myself, temporary defeats are not permanent failures. Temporary defeats are not permanent failures. And I have to remind myself when I hit a roadblock, like, there's something else out there. There's a detour. It's not permanent. So for me personally now, the person I am now, definitely building up. But the person I used to be was most definitely held back by fear, and that's why I do the work that I do now about facing fears.
We've been going strong for a good period of time. We're going to take a little short break when we come back. Guess what, Black Men Talk? Mr. Maurice, Mark Kelly, Mr. Charles, and Marcy Baptiste. To take credit for this, but I just can't. I saw this on the back of a t-shirt of a gentleman about a week ago, and I read it real quick, and it stopped me in my tracks. And after my tracks came back to me, I wanted to go speak to the gentleman about it, and he was gone, and I couldn't find him. But I wanted to find out where he got it, what his thoughts were. But it was a simple statement, but it's profound. Many gifts, one spirit, Marcy. If I say that to you, what is your interpretation?
Can you repeat that once? What?
Many gifts, but one spirit. Actually, take the butt out. Many gifts, one spirit.
Many gifts. That's a hard one. Okay, you stumped me. All right. See what you did there.
We'll come back to you. We'll come back to you. Take your time.
No,
take
that's okay. That's okay. I think that a lot of us are sent here with the many gifts, right? But we do only come with one spirit, and so defining where we want that spirit to focus, like what of my gifts and talents am I going to pursue, and which ones are of value? And sometimes, I know for me, I got shiny object syndrome. I got more ideas than I have time, and so deciding which ones of those things, they might all be good ideas, but they may not be all the right things for me or for my soul or for my spirit. Like, it doesn't align with where my spirit needs for me to go. That's what I think.
Sounds good. Mr. DeMaurice, many gifts, one spirit.
The way I interpret that is that we all come with many gifts, but what energy are you going to use to share those gifts? You're going to use a positive energy to share those gifts and so they manifest not only within yourself but in others to bring out the best in others. So when I look at that quote, it's like you're given many gifts. How are you going to use those gifts with the energy you have to share those gifts and make a contribution to your fellow men and women out there to use those gifts to their fullest potential.
Mr. Charles, you know, again, I'm back with a t-shirt to us talking about it. Many gifts, one spirit, sir.
Yeah, I think I'm going to kind of piggyback with a lot of what was said earlier. You think about we definitely all have gifts, different gifts, but the focus that you put into each one of those gifts and the time and how you go about it goes a long way. And I think that's investing in things, and then also when you invest helping others, you know, you need to really be focused using whatever particular gift that is. And I think a lot of people, when you think about it, my brothers tell me this all the time. It's like DeMaurice mentioned earlier that it's good that you use your powers or your abilities or your gifts for good. Because we think about how you could do some bad things by manipulation, but that's not what you're supposed to do. But every once in a while, I just kind of get a chuckle because I see other people using their gifts, abusing their gifts for the wrong reasons, and that's not the way you're supposed to do it. But I do agree with what has been said.
Same here, man. I can't really add to anything that was said because other than the fact that, again, just reiterating that we're all blessed with a lot of different gifts, and it's really our job to kind of understand them, find them, and really work them and turn them into one spirit. But yeah, we all are. The size of a mustard seed. You don't have to go really look at and then find some visual pictures of what mustard seeds are, because I heard this for years, but never knew what a mustard seed looked like. But if you have, you know, that right there, that little small size is all you need. Speaking of faith, a strong belief in God, doctrines of religion based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof, because sometimes we're always looking for something to basically look at so we can understand, you know, why something a certain way, when basically we don't need that type of proof, we just need the faith. So, Mr. DeMaurice, I'm going to come to you with this one in a sense. Basically, if you go back into the early part, the infant stage of your start of faith, how was it developed, sir?
Wow. Growing up as a Baptist and growing up in both sides of the family, that they had strong faith and belief in church and in God. Being around my grandmother, Rosalie Woods, all she talked about was the Bible. I can't remember her talking about anything else that didn't relate to God and the Bible, and how she can just lace it with with life, what was happening currently, and how she can see that. There was no way you can walk away from her not believing and having faith. All that she was going through, all that she had went through, and she can testify in her life all the stuff that she went through and all that other stuff, and her still steadfast belief in the Creator and that it was all going to be okay and it was all good. You couldn't walk away from that woman thinking, all right, I can't believe in this because this doesn't work. She had that faith, and it's almost like she poured it into you or just layers you with it when you walked away from it. I've seen Jehovah's Witness come to the house. They ring the doorbell, and my grandma was like, let them in. let them in. And she was like, it was like a battle of gladiators. You know, they talking about their book and she talking about her book and she going at it with them. And they walking off away from the house with the tail between the legs. And a lot of them left the Jehovah's Witness and started coming by and reading with her and talking with her and all this other stuff. So she was ready with that book, that sword, we call it, and, you know, most people, you know, when Jehovah's Witness comes by on Saturdays, you know, you close the drapes and all that other stuff, and, you know, pretend you're not at home, grandma will be like, let them in. I'll be shaking my head when I'm leading them in, like, boy, you don't know what you're running into right now, because she is equipped for the battle right now. Oh. You don't know what you're walking into. This little old meek lady, you know, and she just battling. So if you were around her, you couldn't help but to get it. You couldn't help but to get it.
Yeah. I'm grateful that you and I share the same grandmother, bro, because that's really where it came from. Her and my mom, the combination of them two, because it almost seemed like they took a drill and drilled it into you constantly, just constantly drilling it right into you at all times. And if they didn't think you have enough, they would come back and give you some more. But once they got done with you, man, you were set. You know, it was just at that point, it was your job to build on top of it, to cement it and build on top of it and go on, because they made sure you had an understanding that there was nothing to worry about, that God is never going to give you more than what you can deal with. You know, do the best that you can. And once you get to that point, if you've done your best, you walk away from it and don't look back. It's not in the question. Ms. Marcy, coming to you, at what point and how, if you had to think about it, your faith started to develop?
So I grew up kind of in a split household. So my mom is Caucasian, and she did not go to church. My stepfather was Black, and so I went to church with my aunties and my grandmother on his side of the family. And I didn't really understand church, and I didn't really understand religion. And all I used to remember, the things that I loved the most was hearing the choir sing. And there was one song that I used to really love, and they talk about Jesus on the main line, call him up and tell him what you want. And for whatever reason, that song kind of stuck with me. And so then whenever I would get into kind of a stuck place or I was feeling some type of way, I would just remember, okay, Jesus on the main line, tell him what you want. Like, I didn't understand what prayer was, and I didn't understand how all of the pieces fit together. I just remember hearing my aunties always saying, give it to God. And then I heard the choir saying, Jesus on the main line, tell him what you want. And so that was kind of my first, when I think back, like, that's my first remembrance of my experience with faith. Then when the first time I remember specifically faith really working was when I went through my divorce, and I had initiated the divorce, and my children were very, very resentful of me everyone was resentful of me, quite honestly. But it was in that moment, like, things were so bad, and I was in such a bad place emotionally and torn about my decision, because I felt like my decision was right for me, but it was wrong for everybody else. And I was just stuck, and I remembered going to church one day, and I went up to the altar, and I got on my knees, and I gave my case to God. And I was like, I don't know the right answer. I don't know what to do. I'm going to trust that you're going to figure this out and that we're all going to be okay, but they're yours now. I'm taking my hands off. And I kid you not, within 3 weeks, my relationship with both of my daughters started to improve dramatically. And then there were situations like that over the years where, like, when tell him what you want, tell him what you want, and you start to see it manifest. And at that point, I realized, like, yeah, God got me. He got me.
Yeah, I remember that song, Carry Jesus on the Main Line. Yeah, we grew up in my grandfather was a Baptist minister, so all those songs, man, you bring them back some memories now. Bringing them back. Mr. Charles, where did your faith initiate in this infancy, sir?
I think it started with, I would say, my first stepmom, because my mother had passed when I was real young. And then my dad remarried, and my first stepmother, Miss Vi, was really into the church. And it wasn't like it was overwhelming, but she just introduced me to the church, and I learned about the Bible and read it and everything. And it just became second nature. I loved going to church. I used to love reading the Bible because they had those little cute little Bibles with the cartoons and all that stuff. And it was all colorful and stuff. So I was young, and I got baptized real early. So a lot of things kind of came to me. I felt really good about it. But then as I continued to grow and started to deal with a lot more challenges in life, my faith really even increased because of the factor that for as much as you love to say we can run to our relatives or people that we trust to help you, there are times not even that my father could even help me with situations. And I was like, this is just going to be horrible for me because I'm a kid. I have no recourse to somebody could just do anything to me. I couldn't do anything about it. But I just prayed a lot about it, and I just trusted the Lord. And he delivered me every time. He's still delivering me. So my faith became real strong from that standpoint. And like I said, just knowing that and knowing the truth about it. Some people say certain things for themselves, but knowing the truth, there was not a lot of other options I had to believe in or hold on to. So that's how my faith was able to grow over time like it has to this point.
Ms. DeMaurice, I'm going to give you a question. Choose one thing if you can, sir, to fill in the blank. You don't have to rush, but just kind of choose one thing if you can. The utilization of your faith has allowed you to fill in the blank.
The utilization of faith has allowed me to go and do things that I thought I'd never be able to be or do.
Mr. Charles, your utilization of your faith has allowed you to do blank, sir.
Yeah, DeMaurice took mine, but that's okay. I'm still the same way a little bit. But utilization of my faith has allowed me to become a leader and show others what I'm capable of. And that's something before that perhaps I probably would have never done. But, yes.
Ms. Marcy, the utilization of your faith has allowed you to fill in the blank, please.
It has allowed me to forgive, here to be unforgivable.
Wow. It's interesting because for me, the one thing I would choose was not to be afraid. It's just when things happen that maybe should scare the daylights out of me, it basically just allowed me to not really kind of see the fear in a sense and believe that it's going to be fine. And that brings me to this question that I wanted to kind of throw out there was that I wanted to hear of a time where, not even realizing it, but your faith kind of surprised, what kind of happened in that particular situation surprised you, but not knowing that, you know, it was already going to work itself out. So your faith kind of surprised you in a sense and just took care of it. I'll start this one off real quick. And I might have shared this before, but years ago I was living in South Carolina. I was working at the radio station, and I just got the job. And at the time I was part-time. So because before I went down there, I basically had to get down to South Carolina. I was up here in Connecticut, and my father had this old Deuce and a quarter, 225 Electra. That was a baby. By that time, it was old. He moved on. The car was broken down for the most part, but it still moved. So back then, they had paper registrations, and the car wasn't registered. So I said to him, I said, Dad, I'm going to take the car and drive it down south. He says, no, rest. I know. I'm going to dock up the registration. And I said, if anything ever happens, they call you, and they want to know what happened. Tell them that you went to bed. When you woke up, the car was gone. That's what he had to say.
And Uncle
Horace
went.
Wow.
He went for it. I said, you know, so that way you're not responsible. You just, well, you know, the keys are gone. I was going with it. He said, okay. So 12-hour ride from Connecticut down to South Carolina. And basically I'm driving, and I come through. You go through New York. You go to Pennsylvania. You go to Maryland. I get into Maryland. And it's a state trooper. I see them. He's off on the left. I'm riding. And the state trooper, basically, what he does at that point, he comes full beside me. And he rides for a period of time. And all of a sudden, he throws his lights on. So I pull over, go to the side. And he starts talking. So, you know, he said, I was kind of gauging for him. I said, yeah. So he said, for some reason, he said, your car would, he said, you would get to 60, then you would jump up to 67, then you bounce back down. I said, this is a big motor here, sir. I said, you hit the gas, it just revs that way. So I'm trying to keep it down, but I can't. He said, all right. He said, I'll run your tags, and, you know, if your tags are right, you're good. I knew they weren't going to be good. But he comes back to the car. He said, for some reason, Connecticut takes a long time. They're not responding. He said, all right, man, just drive safe. Old Wolf kept going. Now, when I get to South Carolina, you would think I was just, once I get there, I'm good. I parked this. Now I'm driving this car around like it's made. Like I said, I went to Atlanta. I'm coming back one night from Atlanta. It's pitch dark. And I come around this car. These troopers have this car pulled over. I come around this car. And as soon as I come around the car, one of the troopers that are there takes off, come right behind me. So he pulls up. He starts talking. And he was mainly concerned, I could tell at the time, if I was driving drunk. You got anything to drink? Something? I haven't drunk anything. I had to run your plate, you know, and you'll be out of here. He goes back, run the plate. Connecticut, for some reason, they just not picking up the phone. All right. He taps on the hood, have yourself a good night. Takes off. So a couple of days later, I'm outside of Clemson, South Carolina, and I'm moving around again. It's late at night, and Saturday night, I'm driving around, and all of a sudden, bang, back tire goes out. And when I say it was jet black, this was jet black outside. I'm saying to myself, dang, I got to change the tire out here. And it was so dark. All you hear is the mosquitoes just making noise. And I got out of the car, and I'm walking towards the back to open up the trunk, and this car pulls up. And this gentleman gets out, and he said, oh, you got a flat. I said, yeah. He said, you have a jack? I said, oh, yeah, I have a jack. And I said, I'll tell you what. He said, I'm going to sit here with my high beams on until you finish changing it so you have some light. I said, okay. So I go do what I got to do, change a tire, offer to give him. He said, no. He said, it was my pleasure to do that. I said, but I'm going to tell you. He said, take that money and go to church tomorrow morning and put that in the offering. And that's exactly what I did. So that was a time in my life where faith was just every time it was just kind of chain reaction, bang, 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 bang. And eventually I brought the car back to Connecticut, parked in the garage, and left it there. With that being said, Mr. Charles, I come to you at a time that faith surprised you, sir.
Yeah, got a little doozy. I don't know if I mentioned this to you guys before, but it was the end of my 10th grade year. My father got sick, and he was put in a nursing home. So we had a house trying to figure out how we're going to keep everything going. And I don't know if you know how that goes, but in the nursing home, when your my dad was on disability, they take all the money. So you don't have money to keep things going at the house. And I was in the going into the 11th grade. So long story short, my dad got sick right after school, the school year, that summer. My cousins and my brothers were there. My brothers would come in from, my stepbrothers at the time would come in from out of town, and they spent the summer with me. And it was like nothing happened because my dad was still in the nursing home. So it still seemed like there was activity there. But after the summer was over, everyone left. Everybody went home, and it was just myself. It was just me by myself. So my auntie, my mom's sister, would check on me. She says, well, I know your dad's still sick, but who's staying with you? And I would always make up a fib or a lie and tell her, oh, they're alternating. I would make up one of the cousins was staying with me. But nobody was staying with me. So I stayed by myself my entire junior year. That means I had to feed myself. I had to get myself up ready for school. And I had to go to school. I had to be up on get up on time, and I had to take care of the things my dad had taught me about the taking care of the house. Now, mind you, I transferred schools because my aunt wanted to make sure that she could watch me. So I did that because I didn't want her to have any suspicions. I was living by myself. So I did that, and I transferred to where she worked at. So every day I had to go to school. And my original high school was only a mile away, and that was no problem walking. But the school she was at was 2.5 miles one way to go to school. And I had to walk. And I couldn't get a bus pass or anything. And I just got tired. She said, you're always late, whatever. And I was like, I know. So after a while, I was like, you know, I'm not crazy and whatever. My dad had his car there. I started driving to school. Because I couldn't walk, man. It was too far. So I started driving to school. And I would park 8 or 9 blocks away from the school, so nobody knew I was driving. And I went through the whole year. My dad did not get better until that following summer as I was getting ready, preparing for my senior year. But even to the day she passed away, I don't think my auntie knew that I was driving to school and what I was going through. But that definitely was fake, because there's no way in hell that's supposed to work. And keep the house too? Yeah, that wasn't supposed to work, bro. Definitely fake.
Mr. DeMaurice, your moment, sir.
Yeah, I would have to say my moment was 17, and I was on my way to college, well, before it's university. And even before I was getting ready to go, you know, you had folks that doubted me, you know, family, friends, like, what you going to school for? You need to just get a job and settle down. You know, you got through high school. Now you're trying to, you know, because nobody in the family at that particular time that I knew of had going to finish college, so I was going to be like the first one in the immediate family to do that. And so you're getting a lot of doubt, and I know I was getting a lot of doubt. And so on that bus ride from Connecticut to Ohio, that's all I was thinking about, like, you got to make it. There is no choice, there is no going back home and failing at this. You got to make it. And I remember meeting a young lady who she was a junior at Wilberforce, and we talked on the bus. I think they picked her up in New York. I think her name was Donna. And we were talking about it, and she was giving me the do's and don'ts of going to school and all this other stuff. So as I was contemplating and thinking about, okay, how am I going to do this? This is a new experience for me. I'm going out of state. I'm by myself. She was, I think, placed there, you know, divine intervention to sit there and talk to me about school, what to expect, what to do, what not to do, you know, have a good time, but make sure you take care of your priorities first. And then you meet brothers who are coming from the same situation, brothers and sisters coming from the same situation. I'm talking about Eddie Kelly, Jerry Quinn, Chris Ball, Jonathan Fullwood, Charles Farmer, Mr. Charles. You meet all these brothers, man, who keep encouraging you to finish, to stay strong. And we had our fun, and we did our stuff, but it was always about, you know, taking care of priorities and finishing school. And so even when on the ride there, before I met Donna, going there, just having doubt, like whether I can do this or not. But just like I said earlier in the show, it's almost like always a path clear, or people that step in that help you step for step to go through what you need to go through, and you know you're going in the right direction. So, you know, by my sophomore, junior, and senior year, there was no doubt that I was going to finish. I was on that career road, and no matter what challenges came before me, I was about to do it. I think I told this story to Mr. Charles. It was one of my close roommates, Chris Ball. He had a friend that, I guess, escaped prison, and we were living in an apartment. It was a senior year in high in college. And I guess he was on the lam, as they call it. And he had slept on the couch. I didn't know who he was. So I went to work early. I was working at, Emory Worldwide. I think it turned into Fed Express or something like that. And I came home about 4 o'clock, and I know I had a final at 8 o'clock. So I got a couple of hours of sleep, and I walk out the door. All these guns were at me in the front door, and I didn't flinch. I wasn't scared. I'm like, listen, I don't know who you're looking for, but it ain't me. But I got a final that's due, and I got to get there by 8 o'clock, and I'm going to get there. Now, if you want to follow me, go right ahead. That's how much faith I had. Whoa. I was going to get shot. You want to follow me, go right ahead. I don't know what you're looking for. I don't know who you're looking for, but I can't be late for this. It was Miss Ball, Charles, Miss Ball. I can't be late for this final, or I'm going to flail, and I'm not going to graduate. So, you can shoot me on the way. It'll be a great news story, but I got to get there. And they put their guns there, and they start laughing. They check my ID, like, go ahead. You got. And I didn't come back until late that evening. And then Chris had explained what happened. They came in the house, did a storm, and all that other stuff. But, going to school and not knowing, this is a new experience for me, just getting out of high school. And just carrying that faith. I truly believe to this day that I'm living off the prayers of grandma, my mom, my Aunt Louise, who got me into religion very early, and my dad, who constantly prays now. It's like, 'cause some of the stuff that I get into and some of the situations that I'm in, there is no way I should have got out of them. And for some reason, somebody praying for this fool here to get out of some of these situations, and I know it ain't me. So I got to have faith that it's a higher power looking after me, and there are whispers and prayers that have been prayed over the years that have been sustaining me all this time.
Ooh. Ms. Marcy, a time when faith surprised you. I know you spoke of you were going through with your divorce with your daughters, but you got to have another one. We're reaching for another. I know there's another one coming. I know it. I just can feel it.
I got lots of them. We could talk about this all day. I got lots of them. So this one actually was when I was being assaulted by my ex who had done my domestic violence assault. And he kicked in my door and, told me hostage for hours. And I didn't know how I was going to get out. And I remember, at first I tried reasoning with him, and I wasn't getting anywhere. It seemed like he was getting madder, and it was getting worse. And so finally I just got quiet, and I was just like, oh, dear God, if you get me out of this, I will do whatever it is you need me to do. I will do whatever it is you need me to do. And I had tried to escape several times, to the garage, like different avenues out the house, and The time that I finally escaped, to this day, I cannot tell you how I got out the house because I don't remember the door opening. Like, I cannot, I still have a bruise on my arm from him slamming me in my arm in the door so many times. Long story short, obviously I got out, and I was disoriented. I didn't know where to go or where to start. But through that, after that happened, I'd already started my business, but it was not focused at all on domestic violence. It wasn't focused on a lot of the things that I really concentrate on now. So he sent me to an event through a friend. It was a business. It was a business branding seminar. So I went to it, and I met a gentleman who is now still to this day one of my mentors. And through my meeting him, he inspired me to write my first book and to start a public speaking platform. Now, this is the girl who, when I had to speak, I could do training, but I could never speak about me. So I was a great trainer, but I was a terrible speaker. And I remember one time in the office, we had to do a five-minute presentation about something that represents who we are, and I brought boxing gloves, and that's really all I can remember besides the fact that there was sweat dripping from so many different places that I couldn't, and like there's the lump in my throat, my voice is shaking, I couldn't even hardly get out my five-minute message. And so at some point through meeting my mentor and committing to doing this thing and talking about domestic violence and telling my story, I became a speaker. And it started, I think, the day after it happened in the ER, and I had to tell my story at least 15 times there, and then I had to, when I went to court to get the restraining order, I had to tell my story in an open courtroom. There were about 65 people sitting in court, everybody waiting for their turn. And you had to get up in front of everybody. There was no private consultation with the judge or nothing. But those experiences, I think I probably told my story about 15 times or so that day. And from that point forward, I was never afraid to speak in public again. And the domestic violence was not bad enough to kill me, but bad enough to change me. And so for me, it was just like, I know God got me out. Like, there was no way I was getting out of that house any other way. Yeah. And so I honored my commitment, but I didn't even know how that was going to happen. So that was definitely, faith definitely stepped in a surprise to hear.
Well, I want to do something that, if you don't mind, because, you know, when I'm sitting here and listening and hearing you talk about domestic violence and what you went through, there's something inside me as a man that resonates and makes me angry. And I want to give this question to Mr. DeMaurice, Mr. Charles. When you listen to her and hear what she's going through and she's talking about domestic violence, what is it that you're feeling inside? I'll come to you first, Mr. Charles.
Probably the fact that it just burns inside that that's something that she had to experience, or any woman, because I've always been taught no matter how hard, how mad you get or whatever, you can just walk away. And Lord knows I've been in enough situations, because I'm not perfect, that I just always remembered that. And just knowing how tough that can be and frustrating it can be for women and terrifying. That burns me up, because it's just sad, because men should be better than that. They should be better than that. Nobody deserves that. And that's the first thing that comes to my mind, because I've had cousins and other relatives that have been through the same thing, and it just infuriates me to no end.
Same here. Mr. DeMaurice, your response, sir.
My response is, it reminds me of when my mom and dad used to have what I call a Friday night fight. It used to be that they both got off work on Friday, the drinking started, and then they would have their fights, and then I would be over at a cousin's house spending the night until they passed it up. So Sunday night, we'd get back home. And how I felt as a kid, seeing my mom go through that. And as time went on, they were able to rectify that and really kind of have a great relationship as man and woman without the violence in it. But it always, you get a sense of, you go back into that time for me, go back and how helpless I felt in that situation. And then as a man growing into it, how much of a protector that I wanted to be for women in those situations. And it really kind of makes me look at certain men differently, in a more weaker light, to let themselves be perpetrators or become perpetrators with that, and not being able to deal with their own insecurities and fears and wanting to overpower or abuse their powers in other ways. So it always gets me thinking about that and the work that I did here in Chicago with domestic violence and running domestic violence programs and working with students who work in that field and helping them, not only with helping the victims, but doing work with the perpetrators so they don't create more victims as they go on in life.
Thank you, too, for responding in such a great way. This is part of the show. We're starting to wind down. We're getting to another 8 minutes or so where we kind of throw out and see if anybody have questions, in a sense. I'll come to you first, Mr. Charles, or something. I got a funny feeling if I go to Mr. DeVries, I already know what he's going to ask, man. So I'm going to hold him off for a little bit. But I'm going to come to you first, Mr. Charles, if you have a question.
Yeah, since we have a guest, this is great because we have a female guest, but now we're getting something totally different. How do we see the dating scene right now for individuals that are older and single? The temperature.
Since we like you said, since Marcy said, I'm first, but we're about to go to it. Well, I don't even know at this stage of the game that you can even call it dating, bro, because it's just. Because in a sense, I don't know if you have the time to really learn someone, put the effort into really doing it. So if it doesn't click initially or it seems like it's not worth it, the time is not even there. It's not. I mean, you want the companionship, but the road that you got to travel to really get it. And what happens is you're kind of fixated in who you are, what you're doing. And you don't really want to take time away for it and waste it on someone that's not worth it. So I say dating happens by accident, maybe, to some folks. I think at our age it happened. But there's some folks out there really trying to make it happen because they're on a mission to have something take place. It could be marriage or the case may be. So they're running through it. But I think realistically, for our where we are, I don't think we're really putting the energy into it that it needs to be if we're serious about it. And I don't think we are. I think from time to time we peek our head out, we open the door and see what's going on. But for the most part, you know, there's a bunch of nutcases out there, bro. There's a bunch of nutcases out there. And if you really want to look through the bag and maybe not pull out a nut, it's just what it comes down to. Ms. Marcy, your response, please.
I saw a meme the other day that said the dating pool has pee in it, and I think that kind of sums it up. It's just things are so, like the world is contaminated is how I feel on dating. And I always joke that unless God himself drops a husband in my living room, I'm probably not going to find it because I don't ever go looking. And so I think kind of to tear off of what you're saying, like, it's hard to want to put in the work to see, you know, and dating is exhausting and learning people is exhausting. And if I only have so much energy to give, what do I want to give it to? Do I want to give it to people that I know, love, and care about and who I know will refill my cup? Or do I want to exert and invest that energy in something that's no guarantee of?
Ms. DeMaurice, dating, I'm sorry, Martha. Dating for you, Ms. DeMaurice.
No, you're good.
Man, I think we had this discussion before. Man, I'm out. I'm out, bro. I'm retired. I can't do this. it's too different. It ain't face to face. We've been in a pandemic. You gotta, you know, give me something new. I know the old way of doing it. Hey, you know, you get to know each other. What you like? Or this, that, the other, having a conversation. What's your favorite color? All of being on the phone. I can't do that anymore. I don't have the patience for that anymore. Going in the DM, swiping left and right. I don't know what it is. Me and my cousin, not my cousin, but some of my students, they were talking to me about this this new phenomenon where a guy can has a wife and another woman live with them. And I'm like, I thought, you know, I was brought up thinking that's not the case. You can't have your cake and eat it too. But now you can have your cake. When did I miss this memo? So I'm out, man. I don't know what's going on. I got to just stay to myself, you know, eat my cookies and milk at night, go to bed, watch a movie. I'm out. I can't deal with it anymore. I don't know what I'm doing. I am out of touch when it comes to this anymore. And then when you do get into, like, dating and all that other stuff, it's, you know, it's certain things that kind of sound like you know it's not going to work, and you go, you know what, I don't want to spend my energy doing this anymore. So, you know, you kind of pull yourself back from it. But I don't know if I just have the – I don't have the energy for it. I like Miss Marcy. If the creative just doesn't plop her right in front of me, I'm probably not going to go for it. I'm probably not going to go for it because it's like, okay, is this a trick? You know, then you have exes that come back, hey, how you doing? Hey, big head, all that. No, not going there anymore. Not doing that again.
Not the hey, big head. Not the
hey,
big head.
Yeah. You know how women, hey, how you doing? Just thinking about you. Oh, why are you thinking about me now? What happened? You know, so I'm out, man. I'm out. I ain't got nothing left. Inspire me is what I'm saying. Whoever's going to try to step there, inspire me. Show me something different that I hadn't seen before so I can go, ooh, okay, and I can walk into it just like a fool I was back then and, you know, get me some other way. But the old ways of doing it, it's not working for me anymore.
That was all, Mr. Charles. What you got, man? Dating 2021, sir.
Crazy as hell. Anyway, dude, let me say this. All I know is you just had that moment where you're feeling like, man, I like some companionship, like to really get to know somebody, enjoy those times, feeling really good, ready to step out, meet some people. And then you either meet somebody or you are or most recently, you're in the company of different people and they're sharing. And then you'll hear something like a woman will say what she's been through and her husband did this and he did that. And you listen, and you're like, well, damn, no wonder she ain't really liking men right now. I don't blame her. I'm like, oh, I can't even compete with that. So I'm sitting there going like, damn, hell no. Nah. I'll be back up. I'm like, how you doing? Okay, well, good. Okay, then let me keep moving on. So it's hard out here in these streets, man. You just have to sit out here and just be by yourself, eat by yourself, drink by yourself. And just that's all you can do. It's rough out here, bro. So, as you said, I guess I'm in that boat, too. If the Creator, Lord, brings somebody my way, then I'm open. But other than that, I'm going to keep walking, keep going to the gym, keep doing my one-hour shoot around at the basketball hoop, and just try to keep my mind focused on things I need to and stay out of trouble.
All in milk,
yeah,
work hard, baby. That's my recipe.
There you go. There you go. I work hard to keep a smile on my face. That's it. I work hard. That's hard work right there, bro. Getting a smile on my face. So that's what I'm about. We're going to do a little tribute with some music and get out of here for the next couple of minutes because we usually kind of go right up to the border of 90 minutes. But tonight I'm going to play some music and get out of here because there's a man that turned 80 this week. I was speaking of George Clinton. Think about that for a second. George Clinton turned 80 years old. Now you talk about mental health. That wasn't right. There's something mental with George Clinton. I don't know if it's healthy, but there's something definitely mental with him.
He was just mad. He told the truth because he said Mother Earth was impregnated for the third time. He's right there.
I can't say any better. We got 90 seconds. For the next 90 seconds, you all will hear music. Ms. Marcy, I want to thank you for stopping by. We'll have you back again. You already know that. You're welcome. The door is open. We'll get you back real soon. You two gentlemen, have yourself the next two good weeks, and we'll get together soon. This is for Black Men Talk. Mr. DeMaurice, Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles, and Marcy Baptiste. If we get this button here, go. Come on now. Let's get this kicking.
A good evening. Do not attempt to adjust your radio. There is nothing wrong. We have taken control as to bring you this special show. We will return it to you as soon as you are grooving. Welcome to station WEFUNK, better known as We Funk, or deeper still, the Mothership Connection, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, dealers of funky music, P-Funk, Uncut Funk, The Bomb.
Coming to you directly from the mothership, top of the chocolate Milky Way, 500,000 kilowatts of P-Funk power. So kick back, dig, while we do it to you in your eardrums. Oh, me, I'm known as Lollipop Man, alias the long-haired sucker. My motto is...